You're listening to Biz Growth Live, where we're in conversation with authors and experts from around the globe, bringing you strategies and tips to bring your brand to life. You'll find all the show notes with additional resources for this week's episode at bizgrowthnews.com. And when you're there, remember to register for our free newsletter so you'll never miss another show and you'll get access to more great tips and articles. Well, welcome to this week's episode of Biz Growth Live. I'm delighted that you're able to join us. It is Monday, the 8th of December, and this week we have a little bit of a different style to our show. I'm joined today by not one, but two experts in their field. The first is a colleague of mine from here in Ireland. His name is Patrick Daly, and he is the founder of Alba Logistics. It's a specialist business consultancy focusing on warehouse strategy, design and operation. And you'll find them online at albalogistics.com. Patrick and I have been in contact with each other over a number of years and have worked together. And I was delighted he was able to share with me that somebody in his network was actually going to be coming here to Ireland to run a workshop in the new year. And we thought it would be a great idea to bring that person to our conversation here at Biz Growth Live. So Patrick is actually co-facilitating this week's session with me. The person in question is very well known to those of us who have been in consulting or coaching for any time. His name is Alan Weiss, and you'll find him online at summitconsulting.com. He's been working over a number of years with organisations such as Merck, Hewlett-Packard, General Electric, Mercedes-Benz, and he speaks at major conferences right across the world. He's also very prolific in terms of his content, both online and also in books. He actually has authored over 25 books, and his bestseller probably is on your bookshelf if you are a consultant or coach or selling professional services. You will know it by the name of Million Dollar Consulting. So with that as an introduction, I'm delighted to introduce you to Patrick and Alan here at Biz Growth Live. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you today, Alan. You know, as a consultant and a mentor, your books are actually on my bookshelves and have been read, as I know they have by many of my listeners as well.
Well, don't operate any heavy equipment in that case.
But one of the things I'd love to talk to you about, and Patrick and I have got a number of things that we'd like to explore with you today, is that, you know, one of the things when I'm talking to consultants and the networks I'm in, given the current economy, which isn't particularly healthy in parts of Europe here, and I know it's been challenging in North America, many consultants or professional services leaders are actually finding themselves that we've got clients who are not hiring, investing, and working with external consultants. I was with a group recently, Alan, where one group of consultants, their whole market that they thought they were serving, they're actually not spending a single euro next year on consulting, which has actually got them into a little bit of a concern and a panic. And if you actually were working with people like that, what would be the, you know, kind of the top pieces of guidance you'd give to people? Because, you know, we can look back in the past and say they might have done things differently, but if they are looking and facing into 2009, what would you be suggesting they do to help rebuild their practice?
Okay, I think your question is that people are claiming they're not going to spend money on consulting. So what do they do? What do consultants do to rebuild their practice? And I want to push back on several of your premises. You know, the problem here is that consultants generally have low self-esteem, low self-worth. And when somebody says to me, you know, we're not hiring consultants, my response is, you don't know how many of my current clients started their conversation by saying the same thing. Everything is determined by the questions you ask yourself. And so if the question you're asking yourself is, how do I rebuild my practice because people aren't buying consulting services, then that's the rut you're going to be stuck in. But if the question to yourself is, people are more reluctant than ever to buy consulting services, how do I prove my value on an entirely different plane, then that's what you're going to do. And the fact is, the people who claim they're not buying consulting services might as well claim that they're not going to pay the rent or not as well put on fresh water in the office. They still need value. They still need help. You can still make any kind of value case, such as those companies best primed when these economic times are over, and they will be over, will be the ones best primed to emerge in the new marketplace. And one of the reasons I just ran a self-esteem workshop here, and I'm running one in Dublin in early February, is that consultants have to make the first sale to themselves. So you cannot face the market by saying, woe is me, the economy's bad, people aren't buying services. You have to face the market by saying, what a great opportunity. People really need me now more than ever.
Well, it's a great challenge back. And I know we want to talk to you about self-esteem as we have our conversation here today. Patrick, I'll hand it over to you.
Okay. Alan, I've read some of your books, which led me to attend a mentor program and then to attend the strategist event that you organized in London. And what struck me is the different paradigm that you use with regard to consultancy and selling consultancy based around value-based pricing and the idea of a conceptual agreement around objectives, measures, and value. How does this process actually work with a client when you're face-to-face, and how does that contrast with the traditional consultant day rate type paradigm?
Well, most consultants are selling a commodity. They're selling a day at a time. They're selling participation in a class. They're selling a box of materials, they're selling some profiling test. Those are all commodities. The way I've done this, and I pioneered this in the early 90s, is that the first thing you do is find the real buyer. Not a gatekeeper, not a human resources person, not a training person, they're never really buyers. You find somebody who can actually write a check for your value, or at least authorize the computer to spit out a check. That's usually somebody who's in charge of a profit and loss center, or somebody who's heading up a key staff area, or someone like that. In a small company, it's the president. Or the owner. In a larger company, it can be anybody, a director or vice president, but they have to be able to write a check. Second, you develop a relationship with that person, a trusting relationship. You provide value. You listen to them. You start to suggest things. And as they begin to trust you, you then begin to realize what kind of project might make sense for you to help them with, what kind of value they need. Then you engage in finding objectives, measures, and value. What are the business outcomes? Those are objectives. How do you measure progress? Those are the measures. And what's the impact on the organization? That's the value. Once you have that and the buyer has stipulated to it, which is what's called conceptual agreement, you have everything you need for a proposal. So in my system, you actually work backwards. You find out what the end results are, having had a trusting relationship, so they'll be shared, and then you create a proposal around achieving them, as opposed to coming in and offering deliverables or doing tasks. Most consultants sell themselves short, and they'll never get wealthy, they'll never get rich, but moreover, they'll never establish relationships with the real movers and shakers in the business. The future of consulting is not dealing with human resource people.
Okay. Could you give me an example of what a typical set of objectives, measures, and value would look like on a typical project?
Well, when you say typical, I mean, it depends upon the company. But an organization, for example, might say, our objective is to reduce attrition. A second objective would be to attract more highly desirable talent. And a third objective might be to make sure that talent becomes effective faster. And so you say, well, what are the measures of that? You say, well, the measures would be how long people stay compared to how long they've been staying in the past 5 years. Another measure would be how soon they're able to take over responsibility for their area without anyone helping them. A third measure might be how quickly they fit into the succession planning system. And so forth and so on. You know, another measure might be how many candidates are found that go into the finals as opposed to being rejected. And so the value to that, if you met those objectives, what's the value? Well, the value is you spend a lot less money attracting talent. You spend a lot less money replacing people who turn over, which at least in the States averages about $65,000 per person at middle management just in replacement costs. You gain a whole lot more productivity sooner, which means you're making money and increasing your margins and so on and so forth. Now, those are kind of generic, but you haven't given me a specific instance. But that's an example of objectives, measures, and value. And you get them by asking questions of the buyer and having the buyer provide them.
Okay. How does self-esteem come into this process? It strikes me that to go down this road, you need a certain level of self-confidence that is probably above and beyond what the old paradigm requires.
That's a great question. You know, when I started in this business and I started coaching people seriously in 1996 around the world, I thought that the big problem was they didn't have enough capital. But I was wrong. The real problem is they don't have enough self-worth. And if you are to see yourself as a peer of the buyer, as an equal of the buyer, which you should be evaluating whether or not you want a project as well as they're evaluating you, despite the buyer's title, despite the buyer's office, despite being on the buyer's turf, despite all this stuff, you as the consultant should be able to deal with them as an equal and a peer. And that means your dress, your language, and your demeanor should be of that level of sophistication and professionalism. All of the advice you hear about dumbing down your language and dumbing down your clothing and never dressing better than the buyer is a lot of bunk. And so the reason I started these self-esteem workshops, which are primarily for people in professional services firms, be they coaches or consultants or speakers or lawyers or architects or whatever, is that you have to see yourself as a peer of the buyer, and you have to give the impression just by your presence that you are going to be an immensely valuable resource. Once you do that, fees are academic.
Okay. In your description of the event, the self-esteem event, you mention typical uncertainties, vulnerabilities, and situations that will cause us to perform below our potential as consultants. What are these, and what's the root of least resistance to self-worth and its manifestation?
Well, let me take the second one first. There is no root of least resistance, but probably the most effective way to get there is to understand that you have to talk about yourself in positive terms, positive self-talk. So that, let's just say that you didn't understand a play that you were at. It doesn't mean you walk out and say, I don't appreciate the arts. It means you just didn't understand that play. And similarly, by analogy, if you walk out of a situation where you didn't get a piece of business, you don't call yourself a lousy business person or a lousy salesperson or a lousy consultant. You just say, too bad for them. They weren't smart enough to take my talent on. So the first thing is how you describe yourself and talk about yourself. The second thing, in terms of the most effective way, is to understand there's a difference between efficacy and worth. In other words, you can be good at something, but still not feel good about yourself, and vice versa. You can be poor at something, but still feel very good about yourself. So the ideal is to be good at the things that are really important to you and feel good about yourself. Those are two independent variables. So in terms of what causes consultants, what challenges consultants and what they should be looking at, is that they are often cowed by situations that are unfamiliar to them. But yet, you know, it's a funny thing, Patrick. There isn't an objection in this business we haven't heard. Mm-hmm. And so it's criminal. It's criminally negligent not to be prepared for any kind of objection. Moreover, and here's just an example of the kinds of things we deal with in the program. If somebody pushes back at you or gives you an objection or attempts to reject something you're saying, that's a sign of interest. And a healthy person with a strong sense of self-esteem sees that as a sign of interest and welcomes it. But people with low self-esteem see it as a threat and a direct challenge, and they back away from it. And for a consultant, that's all the difference in the world.
I remember a very funny story I've heard you tell more than once about a former colleague who used a cigar when he delivered the price to his potential client. So it's one thing to appreciate the value of self-esteem in a book or here in my office on my own. But when I'm in front of the client, what are the strategies and behaviors that I need to make my own in order to be able to deliver that self-esteem in the moment when it counts?
Well, first of all, you have to be prepared. And so you have to be prepared. And I don't mean prepared with information about the client. I mean, that's obvious, or the prospect. But you have to be prepared in terms of what your own business model is. So you have to know what the next step is you're looking for. You know, any sales is a series of small yeses. So what's the next thing you're looking for? You're not just looking for a piece of business. Second is, you have to be adept at conveying your value. And that means the most important skill you can have is a language skill. And too many people don't have effective language skills. They don't know how to use a language. They don't use metaphor. They don't use analogies. And so they get very concerned about the fact that the client or the prospect, the buyer, has said something, and they respond very weakly or inappropriately. The third thing is that a consultant needs to be very clear on the partnership that he or she wants to create and has to look at it as a partnership. And if you can look at it as two people, that is the buyer and you, walking down the road together to improve the client's condition, that's a very different mental set from, will I get this business or not? Will he or she give me something or not? I'm going to win and he's or she's going to lose. And so you have to really convince yourself and believe, have the faith that you are engaged in a partnership to help the client and not in a sales transaction.
Thank you, Alan. Krishna, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm just interested in this whole area of self-esteem, Alan. And, you know, I watch you online in terms of what you share in your videos and so on. I'd like to come back to that in a moment. But I also know that you've got a new arrival to your family, a little one, your granddaughter, I think I'm right in saying.
Twins.
Yeah. In fact, and I've got twins too. And I've got little girls. I only do girls, Alan. I've got three daughters. And I'm just wondering, if you were to go back and guide your children or my children or your grandchildren as they're, developing now, is there something that we could, switch or change in actually what we're doing to encourage self-esteem? Because I absolutely connect with what you're saying in terms of people, I found it myself at times in terms of wondering about my worth to a client. But is there something that, is hardwired with some of us and the way we've been nurtured, or is there anything else we should be doing in terms of perhaps catching people early career in terms of developing them in this way?
Well, I grew up poor, and I got street smarts, and a lot was instilled in me by having to fight for everything that I eventually was able to gain. And I found out as I got wealthy that you can't make your children poor. So you can never replicate that for them, and they can never go through those same life-forming experiences because their condition is different. So what can you do? And I found out that what you can do is you can instill values. And no matter who your kids are, where they come from, what their beliefs are, or anything else, you can instill the right values in your kids. And if kids grow up with the right values, for example, that it's better to fail on your own than to win by cheating. It's best to help others because that always rebounds to help you. There's nothing wrong with being the best. There's nothing wrong with trying to be the best. Too many kids feel that by being the best or striving to be the best, they alienate themselves from their peer group. Well, that's a peer group you should alienate yourself from if they don't agree that being the best is a good thing. And so you instill these values in kids, and as they grow older, their self-esteem will thrive because they've got that solid base. In a great many cases, you'll find young adults, and even veterans for that matter, veteran consultants, whose self-esteem is a problem because they don't really have a value basis. They don't really have a belief system. And I'm not talking about religious beliefs or spirituality, although that's important too. I'll say one more thing, Krishna, because your question is a very important one. The psychologists will tell you, and I've done a lot of work in this area, that the most prime factor in self-esteem is the successful management of personal relationships. And if you can manage your personal relationships, your family, your significant others, your partners, your loved ones, whomever it is, if you can manage those relationships well, that is the basis of self-esteem because you feel like your life is in order and under control. And so I advised everyone in the program I just ran, and I'll be doing the same thing in the one in Dublin, that one of the first things you should look at is, if there are damaged relationships in my life, can I repair them? And if not, how can I abandon them?
In fact, that brings up something in my mind. I can think back to, things that perhaps pulled me down or took too much emotional energy. And I realize I had to cut some ties or make some changes. So I can certainly associate with that. Can I share with you something I'm noticing, Alan, here in terms of the people that I'm talking to? And I guess it's a bit like either a pitch fest or a networking frenzy, but there's a lot of speed networking that's going on at the minute. And I know that many people feel a little nervous about going and meeting people or meeting new people. I'm finding a lot of people I'm talking to have been very happy, very comfortable with the businesses up to date, but they're all of a sudden have found that, they're having some challenges and they're looking back in terms of, well, what networking group should I be a member of, or where should I go and who should I connect with, or who can I reconnect with? One of the things I notice with you is that you're very systematic in the way that you connect with people. And I guess you've got some great processes in place. What would you be saying to people at the moment in terms of how they could kind of move that conversation about self-esteem to how it could help them, let's say, reconnect with people or connect with new people when you know they're out there. But you know, I wouldn't be a big fan, to be honest, of speed networking. But there's a bit of a frenzy of those going on at the minute, Alan. I don't know if you've noticed that in North America too.
Well, speed networking is just silly, and social networking is pretty silly in general. I mean, the things like LinkedIn and so forth. If you want to keep track of old college roommates or old school friends, that's fine. But as a marketing tool and as a business endeavor, LinkedIn is just plain silly. It's a waste of time. But to get back to your question, the most important thing is to understand that networking is about quality, not quantity. And some people want to network like they're collecting postage stamps. People approach me all the time. They want me in their LinkedIn network because they're just trying to collect names and create, you know, 3 million contacts. What good is that? And so networking is best done in person. This is still a relationship endeavor. It's not best done electronically. But whether it's electronic or in person, it's best done on a qualitative basis. And so you ask yourself, who is it who I can help and who can help me? Because networking has got to be about reciprocity. So who is it to whom I can bring value and can bring value to me and we can help each other? And how do I find them and how do I establish that relationship? I'll tell you, one of the best ways of networking is by doing pro bono work, because if you're on a committee or a board or a task force or whatever, for a charity, a political fundraiser, for an arts group, you are going to be elbow to elbow with the managing editor of a newspaper, with the managing director of a business, with the vice president of X, Y, or Z. And that means that you will be seen almost automatically as their peer because you're engaged in a similar pursuit, whether it's fundraising or volunteerism or whatever it is. Those are high quality ways of networking plus contributing to a cause. But just working a crowd, that kind of stuff is silly.
I've certainly found that in terms of the associations that I've been a member of. I have to say I have a slightly different opinion on LinkedIn, but I won't go there for today's conversation. But I am interested that you have yourself used videos on your site. I watch those, and you also have a blog as well. One of the things that I often explore in my conversations here at BizGrowth Live are how people are using new media. And I'm just interested in terms of what encouraged you to start to get involved in both of those platforms?
Well, one of my technical people came to me and he said, look, you know, you've got so much intellectual property. You've got this community that's global in terms of my mentor program, in terms of people who have read my books and people who have heard me speak and so on. And I've been to 57 countries. He said, the electronic media, the internet are perfect for you. And he set up this blog, and I began doing videos anyway, which we just put on the blog, and then which went onto YouTube. I do podcasts, which go onto iTunes. And because the way I interact with people, because I do use language well, because verbal skills are very important to me, I communicate in print, I communicate by audio, and I communicate by video and combinations thereof. And a blog is perfect for all three. Works very, very well. My website accommodates all three. In fact, we're launching a brand new website in a month. It's going to be very dramatic and very, very exciting. So I found it's an excellent way to interact with people when you cannot interact in person. And people get to see you and learn in different dimensions, because some people are auditory and some people are more print-oriented and so on. So I want to maximize people's chances to get acquainted with what I do.
Now, I meet many consultants who actually would not be using any of these platforms. In fact, I have to be honest to say that some of them I know don't even have a website as of yet.
Well, that's just dumb, isn't it?
One of the challenges they always come back would be, well, I'm not sure if I've got the time. How much time do you invest? Because, you know, you've got a technical team.
I don't have a technical team. I have a guy who's not on my staff, who has an independent company. Look, I use people for graphics, for design, for audio, for video, who have their own companies. And I pay them just as a consultant would expect a company to pay the consultant for his or her expertise and not do it themselves. Any consultant who says to you, I don't have time to do a website, is just an amateur and shouldn't be in the business. Because what you do is you get somebody to do the website for you. You provide the content and they do the technical stuff. If they don't have the money to do that, you know, let me tell you something. When I talk to people and they say, I'm considering your mentor program, but I'm not sure if I can afford it. And my basic mentor program is $3,500 U.S., and they're 35 or 40 years old, and they've been out of school for 10 years, and they have a degree, and they've been consulting for 8 years, and they can't afford to make a $3,500 impulse purchase. That's exactly why they need me, because they are losing ground. And any consultant who's serious about the business, who cannot raise the money to do a website in this day and age, is not a consultant anybody should hire. It's like a bookkeeper telling you they don't use a computer, they're just going to post your numbers by longhand in a book. It's absolutely absurd. It's not even worth talking about.
So when you've been posting your videos and your podcasts and your blogs, what difference has it made in terms of your presence online and your visibility and connection and building the relationships with the people that you want to do business with?
Well, I don't believe you count numbers of hits or numbers of visits or anything like that. That's a silly pursuit and it's a waste of time. I believe that you build a body of work and that you become an expert and draw people to yourself because you have expertise. I've done studies for the National Speakers Association here in the States, and I've keynoted for them in England, that show that expertise is the most important thing, for example, in attracting people to hire a speaker. And so what I've tried to do is to become the source for solo practitioner consulting in the world. And so I've written more books on consulting than anyone else in history. And if you take a look at the people who are really in a very tight circle, you might be talking about Seth Godin in terms of innovation and David Meister in terms of small business growth and Marshall Goldsmith in terms of coaching and Jeff Gittimer in terms of selling and me in terms of solo practitioner consulting. And so there's five or six of us, and you know, you might add a few people to that, but who have carved out the preeminent place in their particular specialty. And that's what happens when you put intellectual property out there. And too many consultants are not concerned about putting intellectual property out there. They're either scared someone's going to steal it, which is absurd. You know, I've written 32 books. I'd be out of work if people just stole your stuff and that was the equivalent of using you. Or they've got nothing to say, which means they ought to rethink the work they're in.
Oh, I love the fact that you're suggesting that we do put our intellectual property out there. I do find that. I don't know about yourself, Patrick, but many people would say, well, you know, why do you put so much content out there and how on earth do you make any money from your content? But I know that I get leads and I'm sure you do, Patrick, because people find you from what you're actually writing and where you're speaking and, you know, what you're talking about in terms of, particularly if you're actually going to be a platform speaker or you're doing podcasts or you're putting video out there as well. How have you found that? Because I know, Patrick, you've done some work on your online presence in the last few years.
I have. I think it's another aspect of low self-esteem. If you don't want to put your flag out there, you don't want to volunteer some information, you don't want to be helpful to a client before he signed on the dotted line. So I guess that brings us maybe back to the event. I intend to go to this event, but I'm not quite sure what to expect, Alan, in terms of activity, participation, and outcomes. And what kind of attitude should I come on the day? What should I be prepared for?
Well, first of all, it's going to be in Dublin, as you know, on the 3rd and 4th of February, and it's at the Four Seasons. The 3rd will be a full day, and we're going to deal on that day with the underlying causes of self-esteem or lack of self-esteem, the difference between self-esteem and efficacy. There's pre-work for people who register to provide you with some prompting questions to ask yourself. We have exercises in small groups of, you know, four or five, as well as the full group. And we'll be talking about the specific techniques you can use to bolster self-esteem. The second half day, which is voluntary, by the way, the second half day, you can register for the first day or both. We're going to be talking in a smaller group and more individually about people's own issues. It's voluntary. People volunteer their issues as they like. But we found some interesting things when we've done this with the first session here last week. For example, something like 75 or 80% of the consultants in the group felt alone when they were young, either because they felt different from others or because they came from a non-traditional loving household. They came from difficult backgrounds. And look at them today. They're making their career as somebody who's alone. So they've turned that weakness into a great strength. And we found some things like that that were tremendous in terms of personal growth. And I would contend to you that if I'm right, that the cause of most consultants not being successful is poor self-worth, then this kind of a day or day and a half is just about the greatest investment you can make to get past what Krishna was talking about as we started, which is a tough economy where people are determined not to spend money. Now more than ever, you need the ability to walk into the room and let me tell you why you need me.
And the attitude we should bring to the event? Personal attitude?
Just be willing to learn.
Okay.
What do you do, though, Alan, in terms of perhaps yourself or people that you've worked with? Because I think there's a fine line, isn't there, between building your self-esteem and being seen as being arrogant or pushy. How do you self-monitor that?
Let me define it for you. Confidence, self-confidence, is the honest-to-God belief that you can help other people learn. Arrogance is the honest-to-God belief that you have nothing left to learn yourself. And so I suggest you go right up to that line and stop just short. Occasionally, if you stick your foot over, no great crime. But that's where you have to be, with that level of confidence. And by the way, smugness is confidence, is smugness, is arrogance without the talent.
Yeah, I it's interesting because I think, you know, we do want to make sure that we're building positive relationships. We're doing the things that you've suggested in terms of connecting and adding value to the clients.
You know what happens, Krishna? Excuse me. What happens is that the consultant with high self-worth understands that he or she has to build a relationship with the buyer. And low self-worth means they're building relationships with non-buyers, with gatekeepers, with low-level people, with intermediaries. And it kills them because there's no budget there. They don't let them through. There are turf battles and ego problems. And so you cannot, having self-confidence means knowing that you don't have to be liked by everyone, knowing that you don't have to build relationships with people who really can't help you. This is a business. It's not a popularity contest. We're not doing this to be liked. We're doing this to earn money so that we can help our loved ones, help ourselves, and help others.
No, it would be remiss of me, and I don't know if you've picked up the copy of the new book yet, Patrick, but it would be remiss of me, Alan, not to mention the fact that you actually do have a new book that's come out, and I've actually just placed my order for one, so I'm looking forward to getting a copy. But I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that, because it was actually looking at building your practice across the globe, and you've just talked there about the fact that you've had the opportunity to work in 57 different countries. What some of the things that we can also look forward to in your new book?
Well, that's very nice of you. The new book is called The Global Consultant. It's from John Wiley and Sons. I just did, my co-author and I, my co-author is Omar Khan, and we just did a teleconference interview yesterday about this, as a matter of fact, here in the States. And the book is about how any consultant can do business cross boundaries and make seven figures doing it. And the opportunities to do that in person or remotely or through local alliance partners, how you use the electronic media and the internet and technology to enhance your ability to do that, how you develop an international reputation while you're sitting at home, and how to add a global business to your portfolio, because it is a tougher economy, it is a tougher world for a consultant, and therefore diversity has to mean going outside of your borders, and that's what the book addresses. It also talks about some of the best restaurants, the best hotels, and the best clubs around the world if you happen to be there.
That sounds like a good read. I was with somebody today at an Irish Internet Association meeting, and in fact, that's exactly the conversation they were, you know, having with me, because they're finding that they need to spread their wings from certain geographical boundaries. And I think the opportunities of some of these ideas that you've given there, you know, really present an opportunity for growth going forward. I don't know about yourself, Patrick, because you actually work across Europe, don't you?
Yeah, I've worked in Asia, I've worked in North America, I've worked in Europe. I'd just like to ask Alan, in terms of countries or regions that are showing high potential for the future, would you be able to put your finger on some particular regions or countries?
Well, first of all, the United States, even today, has an economy that's 3 to 5 times the size of the second largest, which is Japan. So the United States is a good place for people from outside the United States to work. I keep telling Canadians that, and 10% of them get it, and 90% of the consultants whine that they have trouble coming south of the border. There is no big trouble if you do it right. Japan, however, is in recession, a pretty serious recession. I think that the aspects of the European community are going to be attractive, especially for people who can master several languages, which puts Americans at a distinct disadvantage. But I think there's a lot of potential there. I think that China is going to be a wonderful marketplace because they're lifting so many people out of poverty. I mean, it's one of these things where you start at so low a level that you can make pretty dramatic increases, and the middle class there is growing and thriving. I've always found that Australia is a great place to work. I'll be going back there for the 14th or 15th time in February and again in next October. And I just came back this past October. So Australia, New Zealand is a great place to work. So there are economies like that where you can see tremendous promise. Of course, you two are more expert in this than I am, but there was a point there where the Irish economy was, the admiration of the entire world, and showing what it can do. And it's a little bit in the doldrums now, but I think it's going to come back again.
We hope so.
Yeah, and I think it's also sector specific, isn't it? I mean, you know, there are some businesses, and some of my clients have never had it, you know, so many new leads coming to them. And I'm actually finding more leads than probably any other time of this last 12 months. So I think it's partly in terms of what you're doing. And also the things that you've mentioned before, Alan, that you've actually made yourself visible, you've put content available there for people to experience you and try before they buy, so to speak, so that they actually, you know, get a sense that you're in a position or whoever's in a position to be able to support them. I'm really looking forward to reading the book, and perhaps you might even sign it for me when I meet you in person when you're over here in Dublin in February of 2009. If people want to find out more about your work, though, and events, including the event in Ireland, what's the best way for them to contact you? Which is the right web presence that you want them to go to and find out more about your programs and services?
If you go to my website, which is summitconsulting.com, S-U-M-M-I-T, consulting.com, on the homepage, on the first page you see, there'll be a large box, a graphic that will say Self-Esteem in Ireland. Click on that. It will give full information about the program and, if you're so inclined, the opportunity to register for it. And so all that's right on my website. And you can also read, if you go to my blog, contrarianconsulting.com, you'll find a summary of the points that came out of the last self-esteem workshop that we conducted here last week.
And I entirely recommend that people head on over to the blog anyway, because I certainly enjoy reading your articles there and also catching up with your videos and your writing on the wall, if I remember correctly. That's called, absolutely. So I've been enjoying watching those. Thank you so much for being with us here today. And I hope that's given our listeners here some food for thought in terms of how they might be able to take a different look at being more successful in 2009 than they were in 2008. And if you are in Ireland and you want to look at the program, don't forget to go over to summitconsulting.com. Thanks so much, Patrick, for being with us. And also, thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Look forward to meeting you in February again.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Biz Growth Live. We'd love to hear your comments, thoughts and feedback about the show, or perhaps ideas for future shows. The easiest way to reach us is by calling our comment line. If you're dialing from Ireland, call 01-443-4423. If you're dialing from the US, call 818-528-4423. And if you're calling internationally, call +1 818 528 4423. If you're on Skype, you can leave us an audio message or send us an IM. Our Skype ID is mycommentnow, or email us at commentnow@gmail.com. And if you're in FriendFeed, why not join us at our BizGrowth FriendFeed room? You'll find us at friendfeed.com. Just click on the rooms and join us at the BizGrowth room. I do look forward to hearing your feedback about the ideas and strategies that you've been able to adopt, adapt, and apply to bring your brand to life.